Throughout history, freethinkers have outraged the religious with their wacky ideas about the virtues of free speech, reason, and of course, eating babies. Now, God is dying, and it's time to dispose of his remains. From the pits of hell, Satan sends two puppets of the imperialist West and the Zionist Jews against God, Islam, and tiny kittens to bring you their propaganda and conspire for a new world order. This is Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment with Ali Rizvi and Armin Navabi.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of, Secular Jihadists for a Muslim Enlightenment. My name is Ali Rizvi, and with me...
Do you remember your name?
Yeah, I do. Alhamdulillah. And with me is Armin Navabi. Armin, how are you?
Good. I'm good. How are you?
I am really good. I'm great. And I've been watching your... this is cool. So for those of you who don't know, Armin's been doing a lot of cool sort of Q&As. And it's been really, really interesting. So, yeah, definitely be on the lookout for that. You'll be doing more of those. And I'll be doing some, too. So I think that should be fun.
Guys, today is very important. Topics is very important because I don't know if people understand what's happening. This is a significant event. And it's so amazing to me that more people are not covering it. Like, in Islamic history, in Islamic theology, this gets its own chapter. By the way, Ali, I'm hearing some echo, so when I'm talking, maybe...
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can reduce my mic output volume, which I can't for some reason.
Guys, this is why you come here, right? Because it's unbelievable that this is just going under the radar, right? We having an Islamic ruler, the guardian of the two holy cities, coming out and dismissing... Ali, mute yourself. I'm hearing echo. I'll just meet you myself. The guardian of the two holy cities, the people in charge of the center of Islamic law, the place where introduced Wahhabism to the entire world, the source of one of the, the lands where one of the four Sunni Islamic schools of thought is prevalent, which has kind of dominated discussions about Islam more than the three others. Now, the place where the ideology that is responsible for most of the radical movements that we see around the world, exporting that to all other Islamic lands and being responsible for so much harm and misery, especially in countries like Pakistan or countries that seem to be going the right way, but now going backwards because of the export of Wahhabism, Malaysia, Indonesia, and the whole suffering of countries Afghanistan, many places in Africa, this Islamic school of thought, the Wahhabism, or I don't know what you want to call it, the Hanbalis, the Salafis, the Wahhabis, they go by many names. Right, the Slytherin of the four Islamic, the Slytherin of this four Sunni Islamic school of thought, the land that is responsible for that, its main leader right now, right, the crown prince, Saudi Arabia's future king, okay, unless something dramatically, something historic happens, is now coming out, okay. Not a scholar, obviously, not even very aware of any Islamic school of thought or not a knowledgeable person in Islam, but still a ruler of the most important part of Islamic land, is coming out and endorsing what seems to be somewhat like what many people recognize as Quranism, not quite, but very parallel to that, questioning the type of hadith that the Islamic world, the Ummah, has relied, at least the Sunni world, has relied as authentic hadith for close to 1,200 years now, without question, and reopens the doors of ijtihad for new interpretations of Islam, just single-handedly putting the key in the doors of ijtihad and reopening them again. This, and again, if you think that this man is not a scholar, so he's not irrelevant, may I remind you, for people who actually studied Islamic history, that the rulers were the pickers of the scholars who ended up becoming relevant and changing Islamic history throughout the history of Islam, even rulers who are not scholars themselves, right? If you actually look at the way that certain schools of thought became popular and the reason why some of them died, like one of the ones that we keep mentioning on this podcast is the Mu'tazilite school of thought, was because it ran out of favor with the rulers at the time, right? So the fact that Muhammad bin Salman is not a scholar doesn't make this not a significant event. Ali, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I think that's important. This has a lot of implications for just the future judicial system, the jurisprudence in Saudi Arabia. And you're right. Like, what happens is when you talk about the scholars, you can, like, with it's a religion, right? Islam, like, you can find all kinds of scholars. And the whole thing is that he can choose the scholars that he wants to support his vision. I mean, he's the king. He's going to be the absolute monarch. I mean, he isn't yet, but he will be, right? He de facto is. So I want to read out what he said. So this is an interview that MBS did with a Saudi journalist named Abdullah Al-Mudhaifer. And what he did was he started talking about rejecting most of the hadith, as we know it. So the Quran, you know, they talk about the Quran and the Sunnah. Muslims follow the Quran and the Sunnah. The Sunnah is largely about the hadith. There's these like recorded sayings, you know, whether, I mean, most of the people listen to this, they know what the hadith are, they're the traditions of Muhammad. And he is essentially making the case for rejecting all of them. Well, not all of them, but most of them, saying that they're unreliable, right? And he also, another thing he did was he talked about when he was asked about Abdul Wahhab, right? So Wahhabism is the sort of the form of Islam, or the reform in quote, a form of Islam that's in existence in Saudi Arabia. It's very, very purist, very, very conservative, as you all know. And he said, well, you know, this guy, he's not a deity. Wahhab is not a deity. You know, we don't want him. And he said it very nicely. He's like, even he wouldn't want to be.
Let me give you a 101 because I think a lot of people might be confused about what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, okay. Okay, go ahead. Do that and then I'll read this quote.
Right. So, okay, let's do a 101 on Islam and then a 101 on the difference between different factors in Saudi Arabia, right? And then maybe like how hadith is graded and some terminology on that, right? So this is really, really basic, okay? So when it comes to Islamic teaching, the main two sources are the Quran and Sunnah, right? So the Quran is like a direct word of Allah, verbatim, right? And the Sunnah is the sayings and, you know, the actions of Muhammad, which is supposed to be used as a role model for all people at all time. But the problem with Sunnah, okay, and by the way, I'm talking about Sunni Islam, right now, okay? The problem with Sunnah is like, well, how do you determine what is Sunnah? How do you determine what Muhammad did and say? And for a couple of, this is according to Islamic understanding of history, which is flawed, but for a couple of hundred years, well, like 200 years, it was like not very, they didn't have a really good methodology to figure out what Muhammad, what does Muhammad say, right? And then you had the hadith collectors come into play, and there was a whole group of people that collected the hadith, and there were a whole bunch of other people who graded the hadith. Sometimes they were the same, sometimes they weren't, and it became into quote unquote a science, which is not real science because it's Islam, but they came up with a methodology to figure out how to which hadith is trustworthy, which hadith is not, right? So you know that when you look at hadith based on our standards today, modern standards, and our standards here, and most people who watch and listen to this podcast, which happens to be the correct standards, we look at the Quran, we look at the hadith, and we're like, well, that stuff is insane. This is crazy. What the hell is wrong with you people? Why are you following this nonsense, right? Like we have fun selecting some of the hadiths or some of the Quranic verses and be like, look at this barbaric nonsense that some people believe in. However, we also point out that the Quran is actually a very short book. Most Islamic ruling, most Islamic laws and practices and rules comes from the hadith, not the Quran. You know, but in Sunni Islam, and the four schools of thought in Sunni Islam, there are six books that are considered very authoritative when it comes to sources of hadith. the two most important one being Sahih Muslim and Sahih Bukhari. And Sahih means authentic. Like based on the grading of certain imams in early Islamic history, they came up with ways to collect the hadith that they consider to be completely authentic. And the authority of these books, like Sahih Muslim and Sahih Bukhari, is second only to the Quran. And basically anything that is in these two books is considered to be authentic. So whatever these books say, like that Muhammad said and did, the Sunni Islamic schools of thought trusted, and they have been trusting it for more than 1,000 years now. But given that most of the ridiculous Islamic teachings and some barbaric and some insane stuff, a lot of it comes from the hadith, right? Like most of it. I mean, the Quran is also batshit crazy, but like most of it comes from the hadith. And given the modern standards for what we consider sane, some people have tried to dismiss the hadith, which is really hard to do because the Quran specifically mentions in the Quran itself that you need to follow Muhammad as a role model. And if you don't have the hadith, there's no way to figure out what Muhammad said and did. So dismissing the hadith is almost impossible. And if you dismiss the hadith, 90% of what we recognize as Islam will go out the window. Islam will become unrecognizable as a religion. It will become, you know, I don't know what it would be. But the Quranist movement, which was a fringe movement, was a failure. The Quranist movement is a movement that just wants to rely on the Quran itself. But now, ever since then, we had some other group of people that don't want to dismiss the hadith because that's such an insane proposition, that instead they want to put doubts in the hadith and like maybe like question the hadith and come up with methodologies that are much more strict on the hadith so that you could become dismiss a lot of the hadith more. You know, come up with ways for more Muslims to be like, you know what, we can't, you know, okay, yeah, we like the hadith as a tool, but is it really as trustworthy? Like maybe like our method, like maybe just because it's a hadith is sahih, maybe that doesn't mean it's true. Okay. And you can see like people like, I don't know, what's the guy's name? Susie knows names better than me. But there are some so-called, some people who don't consider themselves reformers, but they are considered reformers by Salafis. They come out and we've seen them doing something like that, but very gently, like not, they don't push it that much. Mohammed bin Salman just last month came out and he just jumped a doozy, like he just dropped a doozy in all of this. Like it was like an interview that he is suggesting a methodology that would dismiss 90% of what we consider authentic hadith. Like he's going, you know, the grading that we have of hadith, like we have Zaif hadith, we have Hassan Zaif, we have, you know, Sahih hadith, which is the authentic ones, right? Zaif is like poor, not very trustworthy. Hassan is like good. You could trust it a little bit, but not certain. But Sahih is like very trustworthy, right? But now he's like putting that categorization of hadith aside, and in this interview he suggested like we should be focusing on a different categorization of hadith, which puts hadith in different categories. One of them is mutawatir, right? And mutawatir is something that some scholars have been talking about in Islamic recognition of what hadith is, how to categorize hadith for a while. But it is not something, again, this is something that I didn't know until recently, that mutawatir was not something, and I might be wrong about this, but this is my understanding, that mutawatir is not something that the four imams that are considered the founders of four Islamic school of thought and also the hadith and Imam Bukhari or Muslim, none of them like seem to have had that categorization. This seems like a later invention, right? And this mutawatir categorization is a standard for hadith that is really hard to meet, because for you to be able to meet mutawatir, for the chains of narration have to, for that hadith has to be really good, and there has to be many of them at the same time. Okay. For a specific hadith, is either if the last it could be completely verbatim the same hadith that is mentioned many times, or it could be just the same in action or something like that. There are some other conditions, but it makes it really hard. But based on this categorization, a hadith could be authentic but not mutawatir, and therefore these people are putting doubt in a hadith that it's even sahih but not mutawatir. But if you have that categorization, a lot of hadith will go out the window. Ali, you want to say something before?
I wanted to say, like, you know, when you're talking about without the hadith, Islam would become, you know, unrecognizable. So it is true that a lot of people right? Remember, Shia and Sunni, for example, have completely different sources of hadith. They just tend to align a lot, so you see a similar sort of phenotype for the way that they practice. So it's not that that would go away, but just hadith in general as an entity, if you don't have it, the Quran, for example, tells you to pray two or three times a day. I can't remember which one. It doesn't tell you to pray five times a day. It doesn't tell you that there's five prayers. It doesn't tell you how to pray. So everything you see of everybody bending, bowing towards Mecca, the motions that they go through when they're praying, that universal image of Muslims, right, is not in the, that all comes from the hadith.
Hajj. The Hajj.
Yeah, Hajj comes from the hadith. Who are the contemporaries? The contemporaries of Muhammad, the only two contemporaries of Muhammad that are mentioned in the Quran itself, are his uncle, like Abu Lahab, and his adopted son, Zaid bin Harith. Like, none of the other contemporaries, his wife, all of that, any of his wives, none of them are actually mentioned there in the Quran. So a lot of this stuff we get from the hadith. So if you're getting rid of the hadith, the punishments, like the, and this is actually MBS, I talked about this in the interview, like the punishment for adulterers, stoning to death, or the death penalty for people who have married people who have sex outside marriage, which is implemented, you know, in a lot of really, really conservative Islamic societies, that's from the hadith, that, you know, rajm is not something that is in the Quran. So there's some really circumcision, male circumcision is not mentioned in the Quran. Like there are countless things that we see that we think of as part of Islam, that are part of the Islamic phenotype, the manifestation of Islam that you see in practice, are not in the hadith. So what happens is that when he talks about, now Armin's saying Islam becomes unrecognizable, there are a lot of these really, really, really fundamental things, whether it's about Islamic history, or if it's about Islamic practices, or even the pillars of the Sunni pillars of Islam, right? The fasting and the prayer and the Hajj and all that stuff. These are all the hadith-oriented things, the methodology of it. So it truly does become, I mean, the implications for this are massive. Now, will it go that far where it becomes completely unrecognizable? Who knows? I mean, in the short term, probably not. But this is, everything's up for grabs. That's the point. Now, everything is kind of up for grabs. There is a casting doubt. Everything can be debated. New points of view can come in. You can't have legal punishments, for instance, based on... they can be debated. There's a way that you can argue against them. You can bring counterpoints to the mainstream narrative. And that I think, that's a really big, significant aspect of this. Should we read his quote really quick?
No, I wait a second. So first of all, Susanna is saying you were thinking of Shabir Ali. Yes. Susanna,
yes.
The expert on Islamic scholars in the live chat, is telling me this person that I forgot his name. Thank you so much, Susanna, for that. And Bulbul is asking, can't you get the role model stuff from Sirah instead of Hadith? So for people who don't know, the Sirah is like the biography of Muhammad's life and all that, and the history. Those are not considered as trustworthy in Islam as the Hadith. There's no, like, the science that again, quote unquote science, that exists in Islamic school of thought when it comes to authenticating the Hadith, the mountain of Islamic so-called scholarship that exists around figuring out which hadith is authentic and not. None of that exists for the Sirah. None of that exists for the basically biography and the history of Islam. So, you know, this is why, for example, when you see the people, the content creators who make content against Islam, when they want to attack Muhammad and they take something from the Sirah rather than authentic hadith, we'll be like, oh, Muhammad did this. Isn't that ridiculous? Then some Muslims come like, you just took that from, like, we don't even know if this is, we don't even have trust, we don't have yaqeen that this is actually a true story. You just went and took it from the Sirah, not from the authentic hadith. So those are not considered trustworthy by many. I mean, they don't say it didn't happen. They don't deny it, but it's not considered to be, like, absolute sure that this is what Muhammad did and say. That's, yeah.
Yeah, the other thing is, like, a lot of the stuff that's important in the Sirah in terms of being able to follow Muhammad as an example is already in the Hadith. Most of the vast majority of it already is. Can you highlight Susanna's comment? I will respond to her.
Yeah, actually, this is what I had in my note to say as well. So Susanna's saying, even if you throw away all the Hadith, the Quran is still a horrible document to have it, yes, as a constitution. Here's the thing. That's actually something that I wanted to come back to, because a lot of stupid people, when I post this, like, I mean, I get frustrated. That's why I'm calling them stupid people. Sorry, but Mohammed bin Salman is like, oh my God, this is progress. This is great. This is not progress. I'm going to come back later to tell you why this is not progress in any shape or form. Even people are like, oh my God, you're getting rid of all horrible parts of Islam. The horrible parts of Islam is in the goddamn Quran, right? Like you have child marriage, sex slavery, amputation, woman being worth half of men in many, in at least two completely unique different ways, mathematically calculated as woman being worth half of men. That's all in the Quran. Even if you get rid of 100% of the 100% of the hadith, the Quran, and people are like, well, Armin, this is progress in the right direction. No, it's not. This is actually not progress at all, right? Because this is an attempt. So basically, if you think this is progress in any shape or form, there is you believing that is proof that this is not progress, right? Because you are the fools that most people like Mohammed bin Salman are using for keeping Islam more relevant and continue its relevancy and authority, but by throwing signals at people that there's hope for Islam, for you people to be like, oh my God, this is progress, right? So the fact that you are so successfully being used by Mohammed bin Salman shows that this is not progress, but this is actually an attempt to make Islam remain relevant and remain in authority in countries like Saudi Arabia and other places without actually moving towards enlightenment values. Because everything that we care about when it comes to modernity and enlightenment values, the Quran stands against that. So any attempt to make the Quran and Islam remain more relevant is the progress in the wrong direction. Yes, we're progressing, but backwards.
Yeah, I have a slight disagreement with that, and I'll come to that in a bit, but I want to read the next comment from Susanna, because she said, I disagree, Ali. Without hadith, it would be unrecognizable. It's still really, really bad. Wife beating, sex slavery, killing apostates and homosexuals. So you're first of all, there's nothing to disagree about. I'm not doubting that at all. When I hope I didn't come across wrong. I'm not saying that without hadith, it would be, it would suddenly be good. I just said that it would be phenotypically, it would be unrecognizable if you got rid of the hadith. Then people wouldn't be praying all the same way. Like a lot of the things that are explained there are in the hadith that are prescribed in the Quran, like prayer and so on. But anyway, aside from that, if we take it, the wife beating, yes, it's in the Quran. Sex slavery is in the Quran. Killing apostates. Apostates are disbelievers, so that's in the Quran. Killing homosexuals, for instance, the death penalty for homosexuals is actually expressly not in the Quran. That's something that's not written in the Quran.
Child marriages.
So, I mean, child marriage is in the Quran in the sense in Surah 65, verse 4, you know, it gives you instructions on how to divorce your wife if she hasn't menstruated yet, right? So that's mentioned. That's the only real mention of child marriage. And then the rest of it comes from, like, the whole Aisha thing from the Hadith. So there are... Where I disagree with Armin about that, this is not, like, you're right, it's not progress. I mean, eventually you still have the Quran as a founding document. The Quran's a backward book. I mean, and he said, like, MBS said that, you know, the Quran would still be in the constitution of Saudi Arabia forever. So that's clearly not a good thing. But the progress part here is that something that has been very, very fundamental, and maybe not for people like us, me, who was raised in a way where we already were thought the hadith is secondary, but for Wahhabis and for Salafis, something that was considered fundamental is now open to question. Like that part of it, like saying that, okay, you can question this now, like this was as unimaginable as questioning the Quran is right now. And the fact that this step is being taken, and this is the credit doesn't, I mean, MBS is a horrible, horrible human being. So this is not really totally credit to him. But for someone in that kind of power to be able to change the entire structure of the muftis and the people that he's going to get in to try and create this, support this vision, setting that precedent, I think, is a kind of progress. It's not the kind of progress where everything will be amazing, but the questioning aspect, the fact that this isn't as cemented as it was before, I think that objectively is a form of progress. Even if it's not super, super... we do disagree. And we've heard your point. I just wanted to make mine too.
Well, I need to respond. Okay, first of all, I never suggested that... This whole idea that, Armin, it's not... Even if it doesn't fix everything, this is still progress. Like the idea that I would make a binary, make it black and white logical fallacy is, like, I think, laughable. I am constantly fighting against people who make black and white statements. Obviously, I am for small progress. Nothing has to be completely 100% effective for me to endorse it. Even if it's a small positive, small move in the right direction, I will still endorse it, right? But this is definitely not a small progress in the direction. This is definitely a giant leap in the wrong direction, okay? So the fact that people are questioning this, and that makes it a good thing, I'm completely against that. We have, throughout Islamic history, we have seen the how harmful people have, like, there are many examples, like, just the idea that this is like encouraging the questioning of mainstream Islam, and that makes it a good thing, goes against many examples that we have. Again, my examples doesn't mean that this is not a proof, but it also puts doubt into suggestion that attacking what is mainstream right now is always a good thing. You know who also attacked what was mainstream? Ghazali. He was a disaster, okay? You know, Ibn Taymiyyah, okay? Ibn Hanbal himself, okay? Abdul Wahhab himself. These are people who were, every single one of them, people that came and completely started questioning and doubting what was considered mainstream around them at that time. And every single one of them was a disaster to the people around them and caused a lot of misery, right? The thing is that here's what I tell you, okay? This is not progress by itself. This is a sign of progress, okay? So progress is happening. Islam is under attack. Islam is being cornered. This is a defense mechanism, okay? So what I acknowledge is that there is progress happening. This is a measurement of the progress that is happening, but it by itself is not progress. Because it's a defense mechanism against making Islam irrelevant, less and less relevant, because it's a defense mechanism, therefore it's harmful. Because the defense mechanism should not work, right? This is a defense. This is we attacking Islam. People, Islam is under attack. Islam is threatened. This is a way for keeping Islam relevant. Our role in this is to make the attempt at keeping Islam relevant not work. That is what we're supposed to do. Okay. Anyways.
Yeah, but yep. I mean, the thing is that if you, even this is about, it is keeping Islam relevant, what you're doing is you're giving a version of Islam light that is more palatable, potentially extending Islam's life, right?
Like Ghazali.
Like trying to make it compatible and, you know, Protestantizing it or secularize, whatever you want to do. I mean, it's not secularizing, but trying to move in that direction, the whole reform thing, we've talked about that a lot. Yeah, we both agreed that's a bullshit effort. But just the idea of who this person is, what country he's from, the kind of power he has, and what he's saying, and how unprecedented that is, at least in the last few decades, that I think is a sign. As you said it, a sign of progress.
Not progress itself.
Nothing's happened yet. It's not progress itself.
No. Nothing happened. No. Okay. You're missing the order. You're missing the way things happening. You're like, nothing happened yet. This by itself is harmful. Okay. What he is doing, when I'm saying it's a sign of progress, that means progress has been made by other people. This is a sign of them being afraid and trying to defend against us. Okay. So progress happens, then reform is a defense mechanism. It's not like reform happens, therefore progress comes after. Okay?
I agree with that. And I think entire process, like responding to it, I know that you're saying that it makes Islam, I get your point that it makes Islam relevant and they're trying to keep it relevant. I just don't think that relevancy will stick. I think that what the other people are doing is going to happen. So I don't, and I think that all of that is a sign of progress. All of that is progress. So,
those are two completely separate things. I'm just going to move on.
Yeah, I know. Saying
it's a sign of progress and saying that this is progress, those are completely two different statements, and I want to make sure that people understand it.
But I think they're both true, but only in the context in which I explained it. But let's move on.
All right. We do have to also move on to the political aspect of this, Ali, because the relationship between the House of Saud and House of Wahhab. You want to – I don't know, for people who don't know this, the House of Saud and House of Wahhab got married together figuratively and literally, right? Like it was an actual marriage between the two families as well that brought this unity together. At first, it didn't seem like they have that much of a hope, but then things happened and all of a sudden they became the rulers of Arabia, okay? The role of these two houses, the House of Saud, was the political power, the especially and the wealth and the weaponry, the people that were actually doing the fighting early on, and the political, like they didn't. It's very interesting because from early on, they didn't seem to be that much into Islam as much. They were just a group of people that wanted power and wealth. And to this day, they maintain their role in this marriage. They maintain their role. The House of Wahhab, which was united with House Saud, brought the religious legitimacy to this union that this political entity needed for gaining followers, right? The thing with the House of Wahhab is that it was like they followed Abdul Wahhab, which was a follower of the Hanbali school of thought and of one of the four schools of Sunni Islamic school of thought, most notoriously among us, famously among the Salafis, a follower of Ibn Taymiyyah. And you could be basically the Slytherin of the four Islamic school of thought. But Abdul Wahhab took that and just put Hanbalism on steroid, right? Like he started going against everybody that is not following his understanding of Islam in such an extreme, violent way. So if you have like Imam Ahmad, like Ibn Hanbal or Ibn Taymiyyah, these were scholars, right? These were people who wrote stuff. But Abdul Wahhab, he was like a scholar plus the person that did the killing himself as well. Like he was when you look at radical Islam around the world and you see like, oh my God, what the hell is this? I mean, when you see the ideological background behind ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Taliban, it all comes from the exporting of this Islamic school of thought out of Saudi Arabia, especially after 1979, following the revolution in Iran, and with Iran trying to export its version of Shia Islam, which is the Velayat Faqih version of Shia Islam, outside of its borders. And the way that motivated an attack by Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia on the Kaaba itself in the same year, 1979, motivated the Sauds to revisit the relationship they have the Wahhabis, right? So yeah, if you understand, before 1979, there was a union between the Wahhabis and the Saudis, but right before 1979, Saudi Arabia was moving in another direction. Saudi Arabia was had a lot of oil, and its main customer was United States of America, and they really loved this relationship. And Saudi Arabia was like, you know what? We don't need the Wahhabis anymore. We like to become westernized. Thank you very much. So they brought like McDonald's, and they brought like Coca-Cola, and they brought American cars, and they relaxed the rules. And there was like, we could watch news with female reporters without the hijab. It was like, yeah, we're moving past the Wahhabis. We like to become westernized, right? The Saudis like never cared about Islam that much, right? They don't today either. But then what happened was the revolution in Iran happened, and you had you had Muslims rising against the monarchs and wanting representation. And the people in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabis, like, yes, please, thank you very much. We don't like our monarchs either. We could do the same thing, right? And they rose against the Saudis. And they attacked the Kaaba. There was a bloodbath in the Kaaba itself, right? And the Saudis like, you know what? Screw westernization. We can keep selling oil and buying weapons, but these Wahhabis are scary. They're like, we don't want to what happened to Mohammad Reza Shah in Iran to happen to us. We like to stay in power. Thank you very much. We'll go Wahhabi all the way. Like, oh yeah, we're not gonna doubt you anymore, Wahhabis. We are respect our marriage and Islamic law, Sharia all the way. And not only Sharia in Saudi Arabia all the way, we will fund madrasas everywhere around, like in all Sunni countries around the world, we will export Wahhabism for you, just like Iran is exporting version of Shia Islam. And this is what started the raising of madrasas all around the world. And this is what raised to radical moves groups all around the world, including in Pakistan.
Yeah, I mean, can I say one quick thing about that? Is like the funding of this madrasas, that's for a lot of people don't know, most people know, is in northwestern Pakistan, the Afghan border, around that area. In the Waziristan area, there was a lot of funding of these madrasas, and that was actually throughout Pakistan when the Afghan war was happening against Soviets. And the word for student, the students of these madrasas, Talib means student, and Taliban is the plural of students. So the Taliban were actually the students that came out of these madrasas, right? That's one thing. What happened to Armin? I think Armin's gone. Well, anyway, yeah, so... Armin, you there? Or you got disconnected? Okay, anyway, so I'll go on. So yeah, so that's a big thing. There's the madrasas, like these Taliban, they came out of these madrasas, and that's what they're called students. So the Saudi Arabia actually did fund these things, and that was, so in 1979, these two main events happened. You had the revolution in Iran, which was like the sort of it really brought Shiaism to the fore, and they started exporting this whole Velayat-e Faqih thing. And then in Saudi Arabia, you had this whole 1979, the siege of Mecca, and that brought Wahhabism to the fore. And that really, really amplified the whole proxy war between the Shia and Sunni as well.
Right. So now what's happening is that this divorce between Wahhabism and the Sauds, the House of Saud, is being reattempted. Okay. So the first attempt, they gave up on that, the first divorce. Because they had so much oil money, they're like, you know what? These Western, we don't need to become Western. Like, you know, it's too risky to become Western. Like, there's too many Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, and they could like eat us alive, right? And these Westerners, we have so much oil, and they need our oil. Even if we go Sharia, 100% Sharia all the way, they're not gonna do. They're addicted to us. So whatever, right? No need to Westernize. You know, wait 43 years later, now we have like, okay, we're now desperate for the attention of Westerners because oil prices are, you know, dropping faster than Iraq, and we don't know how much further this could drop. Everybody's talking about alternative energies. I don't know, a few years from now, maybe we won't even have cars that run on oil. Like, this is like, this is really scary, really scary. We're scared. We are being surrounded by Shia Muslims are all around us, and we don't know what's going to happen. And we're scared, like, holy shit. So we need to reattempt westernizing and reattempt at putting the Wahhabis aside, okay, to remain relevant, because we need other sources of funding other than oil. We need tourism, and we need investment. And we being this Wahhabi, being this much, having like Sharia up the wazoo is not going to get us tourism or investment, right? So now, but here's the thing. This new attempt at going anti-Wahhabi by Mohammed bin Salman is much more dramatic than anything ever attempted before, okay? Because this is not just anti-Wahhabi, okay? This is not just anti-Ibn Taymiyyah. This is not just anti the Hanbali school of thought. This is anti everything that makes all four Islamic schools of thought relevant in any way, okay? So this, you know, this is the entire four mainstream Sunni Islamic school of thought is founded upon the interpretation of the Quran and Hadith, and even the interpretation of the Quran based on analyzing the Hadith and the commentary on the Hadith on each of the Quranic verses, right? And Muhammad bin Salman just took an axe and is going at the root of everything that makes all of these four Islamic school of thought relevant for the past 1,200 years. Okay. Not only that, if you had doubted that he's doing that, he's coming out and saying like, hey, maybe closing down the doors of Ijtihad was not a good idea. Okay. So I don't know if people understand what's happening. Okay. So when after the death of Muhammad, people didn't understand, like people think like, oh, Muhammad brought Islam. Muhammad didn't bring Islam, okay? Muhammad came out and lived and did something. What Islam, the Islam that we recognize as Islam today was canonized by a whole bunch of group of people after the alleged death of Muhammad for about 200 years until finally we got a form of something that we look at and today we recognize as Islam, okay? And this was done by a whole bunch of people, theologians, scholars, faqih people, whatever, mutakallimin, all of this. And a lot, some the people who are the founders of these Islamic school of thought, they relied on hadith collectors and the people who authenticated the hadith. Everyone had their role, okay? But so the authentication of hadith was the base of how other people like the founders of Islamic school of thought relied on other authenticators. I mean, when it comes to the Hanbali school of thought, the authenticator and the collector and the founder of Islamic school seem to be the same person. But for all the other three ones, they relied on other people to authenticate the hadith for them, and they came up with their interpretation of what is Islamic and what is not. Okay, even understanding the Quran is relied on this base. But at some point, the understanding was like, okay, so these four Islamic school of thought, right? They answered everything. Okay, they answered everything. Now we understand how to read the hadith, how to interpret the Quran. Everything has been answered. Okay. And that's when they say the doors of ijtihad was closed. And these four Islamic school of thought, that you have to understand, these are not contradictory Islamic schools of thought, right? It's not like Sunni Shia. These four Islamic schools of thought, they completely accept each other's authority. You could pick and choose each one you want based on your own reason. Like, they don't takfir the other ones. They don't say the other ones are not legitimate, okay? But they answered everything, and now the doors of ijtihad, that basically you could understand the doors of ijtihad. This is not an accurate translation, but you can understand it as interpretation, okay? The doors of interpretation of what these meanings of the Quranic verses and hadith, those are all closed. And be like, if now what the faqih, what the ulama do after this, like since 1,000 years ago, is just to understand how these interpretation might apply to your unique situation or to modern times or to this political situation or to this family fight. It's not like they're reinterpreting the hadith or the Quran. It's just like their role is not to say, like, how does this apply now specifically in this situation? But everything has been answered. Nobody needs to revisit the interpretation. And if you try to revisit the interpretation, you're doing bid'ah. You're doing innovation. You're, you know, shut the hell up. You're a reformist, and the Quran has told us that you reformers are all supposed to go to hell anyways, right? So the doors of ijtihad was closed. But now Muhammad, so every once in a while, some crazy fringe reformers come and like, oh, no, the doors of ijtihad shouldn't be closed. And here's an interesting thing. The people who don't agree that the doors of ijtihad were closed were the Shias, right? So if you come and say that doors of ijtihad are not closed, you sound like a dirty Shia to these Sunnis, right? Like, what are you, a Shia? Right? So, yeah, Rafid. So now Muhammad bin Salman is coming out saying the doors of ijtihad were not closed. We should reopen them. We should reinterpret everything, right? This is, guys, like this means that Muhammad bin Salman does not belong to any of the Islamic schools of thought. Like, this is not blasphemy just against Hanbali school of thought. This is blasphemy against everything that we understand. Like, I would say, like, I'm not going to takfir Muhammad bin Salman. Like, I'm not going to say, like, he's not a Muslim, obviously. Like, I'm not a Kharijite, right? But I would argue that it would make sense if you say that he's not Sunni. Like, that's too much. But, meh, is it? Like, he's technically not Sunni. I mean, what is Sunni? Okay? He doesn't fit the definition of Sunni anymore. Okay, so anyways, Ali, you want to say something?
Yeah, I was like, Sunni literally means followers of the Sunnah, and Sunnah is all based on Hadith. So,
like, I mean, the Sunni. If you're Sunni, you're like one of these four schools of thought. But he's like not in any of them. So he's not a Shia. He's not a Sunni. He's not like. What are you then? Right.
So okay. So let's talk really quickly, Armin. I'm going to ask you about this again. In the interview, right, he was talking about the Crown Prince is talking about when we talk about a mutawatir hadith, a narrated and handed down from one group to another group, to another, starting with the Prophet. These hadiths are very few in number, but they're strong in terms of veracity, and their interpretations vary based on the time and place that were revealed and how the hadith was understood at the time. Right, so he is from one group to another. So he's talking about the Mutawatir Hadith, and he's actually making a case to retain them. So what are these Hadith, and can you explain that?
Right. So, okay, so most people, most Muslims understand the categorization of Hadith based on what we have had for the past 1,200 years, based on what Bukhari and Muslim and Ibn Hanbal recognized the categorizations of, which was like the main categorization they recognized was like Sahih, Hassan, and Zaif, right? This Mutawatir thing, like what the hell was Mutawatir? Like, well, is it a Hadith? If a Hadith is Sahih, that means it's trustworthy, authentic, like, that's what we need, right? We have like, look, I have a book right behind me, is Sahih Bukhari, right? So when you see Hadith Bukhari, it doesn't say Sahih here, but Bukhari is Sahih, right? So when you say Sahih Bukhari, Sahih means it's completely authentic, right? So why do we need Mutawatir? So Mutawatir, with this categorization of Zaif, Hassan, and Sahih, what you look is you look at the chain of narration, from Muhammad saying or doing something all the way to some, like Muhammad saying telling Aisha, and then Aisha telling this person, and then telling that person, and then that person, until you have the final report where it's written down by the Hadith collector. Okay, so you look at that chain of narration, and there's many way to authenticated chair of narration, but a simple version of it is that you look at everybody in this chain of narration and you see whether or not they're trustworthy. Whether the first person who took the chain of narration, would that person like dare themselves, or they heard it from someone else? Basically, you take the quality of the chain. There's other aspects of it that you also analyze, but the main important thing is that you look at the quality of the chain. By the way, this is all nonsense, okay? There's no way, like, you could tell that this is all nonsense because you're just relying on word of mouth and you're trying to analyze the trustworthiness of somebody that you've never met many years after they died.
Yeah, like, who authenticates the authenticators? Like, exactly. That's the question.
Who authenticates the authenticator and who authenticates the chain, right? So it's very interesting because one thing people say like, oh, this is the chain, and based on the chain, this is a good chain and this is Hadith. Like, okay, how do you know this is the chain? Who's going to authenticate that this is actually the chain? So there's a lot of problems with this whole process, but this is the process that a lot of people recognize, okay? But then other scholars, many years later, years later, came out and suggested this concept of Mutawatir, which is like based on having many chains of narration of the same basic, like not necessarily this exactly same wording of a Hadith, but certain thing that Muhammad suggested or did, like the way he prayed or said something, many chains of narration suggest that happened, okay? And this many chains of narration shouldn't go like at any point through one person and then go become many as well. Like, they need to be many chains of narration in many different places all throughout the narration, right? So for example, if it started with, I don't know, 10 people, and then 10 people, 10, 10 people, 10 people, and then all reported to one person, and one person said 10 people say, and then from that one person, then again 10, 10, 10. No, that doesn't count as a Mutawatir because it all relies on that one person in the middle. Or if it relies on, let's say it was 10, 10, 10, 10, and then one person and one not trustworthy person, and then one another person that was not trustworthy, but we don't know who he is, that's still not Mutawatir because it needs to be 10 all the way, right? This is a very strict criteria, and most Hadiths do not meet this criteria. The vast, vast majority of Hadiths like do not meet this criteria, even most of Sahih Hadiths, okay? So the Hadiths that the most famous authenticators, right, Bukhari or Muslim, considered Sahih, do not meet this criteria. So he's saying like, oh, he's coming out in this interview and he's saying like, yeah, some people use Sahih, but we should rely on this categorization. He's basically saying we're throwing away most of what we consider Sahih Hadith. That's basically
So I'm going to read the quote from MBS in the interview, just so people have an idea of what he's saying. And he's going to say a lot of what Armin said, but we're going to hear it. I'll say it in his words. And the second thing is, then after that, Armin, for the last 10 minutes, I think we should talk about the political implications, like what happens with this. Yeah, these poor Kharijites, like nobody likes them, Susanna, you're right. So we're going to talk about what happens for the last 10 minutes, what are the practical implications.
Answer some last questions.
And answer some of the questions. So for the transcript, this isn't going to take too long. So he... when he talks about the mutawatir hadith, right, he's saying when we talk about a mutawatir quote, when we talk about a mutawatir hadith, i.e. narrated and handed down from one group to another, starting with the Prophet, these hadiths are very few in number, but they're very strong in terms of veracity, and their interpretations vary based on the time and place that revealed and how the hadith was understood at the time. But when we talked about when we talk about ahad hadiths, which is handed down from a single person to another, starting with the Prophet, or from a group to a single individual, then another group, starting with the Prophet, there's an individual in the chain, right? This is called the Ahad Hadith, and this is broken down to many classifications, such as correct, weak, or good, and this type of hadith is not as compelling. So he makes this, he talks about what Armin was saying about the sahih, and then, you know, the hasan and the zaif, like the weak, strong, medium hadith. But he says he thinks that right now that this classification, right, whether it's been narrated by many people or a single narrator, is much more important. So I'm going to skip ahead to what he talks about, how the main quote, when he talked about the majority of it. So he says, this is also a small portion of the body of hadith. While a khabar is a hadith handed down from a single person to another single person to an unknown source, starting from the Prophet, or from a group to a group, then to a person to another person, starting from the Prophet, there is a missing link. This represents the majority of hadith, and this type of hadith is unreliable whatsoever, in the sense that its veracity is not established and that it isn't binding. Okay, so he says
he was confusing me before because he's mixing his terminology.
So he's saying that, and then remember what he said earlier, right? He said that I cannot enforce a Sharia punishment without a clear Quranic stipulation or an explicit stipulation from the Sunnah. And when I talk about an explicit stipulation from the Sunnah, most hadith writers classify hadith based on their own typology into correct and weak, but there's another classification. That's when he starts talking about this other classification where he says that, you know, these khabar or these ahad hadiths, which is the majority of them, cannot be used. Right, as a way, and he's directly saying that he can't enforce any Sharia punishments that come from these kinds of hadith. So now that he said this, what does this do? What does it do? What does it look like in Saudi Arabia now? What is being done in Saudi Arabia right now that will change based on if he actually starts putting this into practice and starts transforming the entire sort of religious clerical establishment?
Okay, let me tell you, nothing has to change and everything can change because everything is so wobbly wobbly that you can interpret anything out of anything you want. Okay, because let me just tell you, okay, even if you have only one verse in the Quran, not relying on the hadith, the Quran says that you need to crucify the people who are spreading corruption. Okay, crucify the people who are spreading corruption. What is corruption? I don't know. You can decide. All right. I mean, me and Ali are probably considered spreading corruption based on the criteria of the Quran, right?
Surah 5, 32 and 33. Yeah.
So basically, like, you could go all biblical Old Testament on anyone you want just based on the Quran, based on just one verse that is saying that you could crucify people that are spreading corruption on earth. Or you could be like, you know what, I'm feeling like, no, this is all based on the hadith and I'm not going to do anything. Your hands are untied. You could make, but guys, when you have magic on your side, when you have like, you know, wish like not superstitious nonsense on your type, anything goes. The whole problem is the religion, not like the hadith or this Quran or this interpretation or nothing. You're dealing with superstitious mumbo jumbo. Okay, that's the whole problem. Okay, but here's the thing, and this actually what you said, Ali, is relevant to what Bobo said in the live chat. Bobo is saying, what are the changes in Saudi law you anticipate because of this? Okay, so this depends on whether the Wahhabis are going to take this lying back or are they going to put up a fight, okay? I don't know. This is less of a Islamic question, less of a Sharia question. This is more of who has the upper hand against who and what this is going to look like politically rather than theologically, okay? Who has a higher negotiating power? I don't know, like, how the Wahhabis, like, what are the Wahhabis that are right now doing their secret meetings? Are they all being isolated, separated, being watched by the police, like the secret police of Mohammed bin Salman? Are they like the main key leaders are in jail or being executed? Like, how are, like, I'm pretty sure, here's what I'm almost sure of. They don't like this, right? They're like, everything that gave us authority, everything that is being, gave us power, all the ideology that made us relevant is being pulled right from under us, right? We're being completely dismissed and we are being eliminated. We're being actually eliminated, right? So I'm pretty sure like some of these people are doing something to fight back, but what, I don't know. And I don't suspect that they are completely irrelevant. I'm pretty sure like Wahhabis are extremely relevant somehow in the making of Saudi Arabia. But how is that going to show itself? Like, are they this weak that they're not going to be able to fight back and be a threat to Mohammed bin Salman? Like, or are they planning something grand, you know, or doing something? Like, what is happening behind the scenes? It really depends on what's happening behind the scenes, and I don't know, okay? So that's that. Ali, you want to say something?
I think the question is, like, what Bulbul is saying, that if we, like, we forget about what he's actually going to do. And, you know, someone else, I think Bogey also said, what are the chances that he just walks this back? And you know, obviously that could happen too. But I think the question really is that if you remove, if you get rid of all the Ahad Hadith, which is a majority of Hadith, like he said, like if you get rid of them, then what elements of Saudi law and the Saudi judicial system are not applicable anymore?
Ali, it's here's the thing. People don't need to go to Hajj anymore.
That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying. It's not going to be exactly like a lot of people are like, okay, so does this mean this and this is going to be not going to happen? Like if it was that correlated, right? If it was that one-on-one relationship, right? That would mean that the main source of non-oil source of Saudi Arabia, which is people going for Hajj, that, are you going to question that, Mohammed bin Salman? Are you going to like be like, hey, maybe you don't have, like, I don't know. Like,
let me put it this way.
I'm just saying it's pick and choose. It's like you choose your adventure kind of game.
It'll be pick and choose. The question is that, you know, he's opened the door for people to say, okay, this stuff is up for debate. And Ijtima, that's what the system was. It was a whole thing that, you know, you can keep on reinterpreting things over time very broadly. And sure. Okay, so... Yeah, but the thing that he specifically talked about in his interview, okay, the thing he specifically talked about is punishments, right? Implementing certain punishments. So he's like, you know, I cannot implement a Sharia punishment, right, based on these certain hadiths that, you know, he doesn't think are reliable anymore. Okay, so that was really the point. So, and let me just read the exact.
Let me tell you what's happening. Okay, so. Yeah. The things that he's trying to get rid of are not the things that are mentioned in Hadith. He's trying to find an excuse to make Saudi Arabia seem less barbaric.
Yes.
To open the door for, so it's not like, if you want to see what's going to be removed, it's not going to be like, oh well let me go look at the Hadith. Well, all of this is out the window. That's not how they're going to pick. They're going to pick like, what is making us look like goddamn barbarians, and how can we like make us look more moderate? Okay.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
That's what is going to be removed. But here, the problem with that is that just like Mohammad Reza Shah, who didn't understand that modernity relies on actually building the Enlightenment values from bottom up, he's just going to go for giving the look of modernity and rather than actually being for modernity, right? You know, so he's like, so we're like, oh yeah, let's open the theater, like open the theaters, let women drive, blah blah blah. But are we going to stop punishing the people who dissent? No. Are we going to actually let people vote their people who represent them in government? No. Are we going to let people protest? No. Are we going to like have secularism? Are we going to have accountability for the government? No. We're just going to do the things that makes it, it gives the signs of like, oh look, we're just going to put lipstick on a pig.
We're modernizing. Look like we're
modernized, but actually become even more brutal, more like barbarians behind the scene in our prisons. We're going to torture people. We're going to imprison people. We're going to kill people who are standing against our authority. So this is like a fake sign of like, here's the thing. These people are desperate, right? They want more people to come invest. And they're just like, guys, what? He's acting like Wahhabis are the source of people being afraid of coming into Saudi Arabia, or people protest, like people objecting to, like he's saying, like, guys, hey, my fellow Saudis, you know what? These Wahhabis, they make Saudi Arabia look scary. That's why we don't get investments. That's why people are not investing in Aramco. Bull fucking shit. You know who's actually causing all the investments to fly away from Saudi Arabia? Mohammed fucking bin Salman, okay? Like, wasn't it the killing of the Khashoggi that made the entire world unite against Saudi Arabia? Wasn't that the main source of, like, funding and all these, like, people like abandoning their plans and investments and tourism money and singers and everything? Like, Mohammed bin Salman, if you want to do a favor for Saudi Arabia, the worst thing for Saudi Arabia, more than even the Wahhabis, is you. You are the worst thing for Saudi Arabia. And the Saudis and the Yemeni people, your human rights violations has been you single-handedly, and you and your organized and the people around you have been cause for more human misery than all the Wahhabis combined. And you don't even give a shit about Islam. Me, as an anti-Islam activist, will tell you that this motherfucker who doesn't even give a shit about Islam has been more harmful to humanity than all the Wahhabis that breathe, eat, and shit Islam. This man has been worse than them combined.
Yeah. So I think what he wants to do is he wants it to make it look more like the UAE. Or the UAE, it's the same thing. They're the same kind of crackdown. They don't want political dissent. They don't want anything. They'll throw you in jail if you go against their elite and their monarch. They're the same kind of thing. They don't have democracy there either. It's a monarchy as well. So they don't have any of that stuff. But they have – people can go on tour. People can go – like Westerners can go to Dubai and feel really good about it and shoot Mission Impossible movies at the Burj Khalifa. But anyway, so
– you want to answer Bulbul?
Yeah. So we're wrapping up. We're just going to answer some of these questions. Why does Saudi need – Bulbul is saying, why does Saudi need tourism when they have Hajj, right? They need more than just Hajj, right?
Yeah, they need more.
It's not just tourism. I think what they want is they want – Western, not just Muslim people. Only Muslims are allowed to go into Mecca and do Hajj. They want people who want to invest in their industries and everything like that, because the oil thing is just not going to work. They had this one trick pony for a very long time, and it's not serving them well anymore.
It's not enough. They desperately need to diversify. The whole 2030 vision is because they know how dire the situation is. Like, guys, the Saudi government is looking more shaky than, like, a lot of people ask me, like, Armin, when is the Iranian government is going to fall? Like, I don't see it likely. Like, anything is possible, but I don't see it likely. But it's very interesting that people are not asking that about the House of Saud. I'm not saying they're going to fall, but it's a lot more shaky right now in Saudi Arabia right now than in Iran. And you know, Ali, if you actually look at the tourism videos they're making, there's nothing Islamic about them. Like, have you seen some of the Saudi tourism ads? Like, there's not a single mosque, there's not a single hijabi woman, there's not a single Islamic, Quranic, Arabic calligraphy. It's all just like desert sanding beaches, like palm trees. Like, they're like, guys, like, we're not like you guys, there's other reasons like to come here. Like, they're really desperately trying, and they need investments, right? The Aramco, the selling of Aramco, the privatization of some of it, it was embarrassing. Their valuations, not, they didn't get the money that they want because of all this. It's coming back at them, like all the crimes that they're committed is making them pay the price. And I hope, guys, don't make it work. Don't let them signal to you. Don't let them, like, torture people behind the scene. And they're like, oh, we're reducing the volume of the adhan. Or, like, women can drive now. Don't let them distract you from all the giant human rights violations that they're doing behind these little tokens that, to just, like, it's a, like a candy. Like, hey, look here. These people need to suffer. These people are sleeping, pissing their pants at night because they're worried about what's going to happen. Oh, the Iranians are going to come and get us because we're not going to have enough money to defend ourselves. Oh, the Houthis are going to come catch us. Okay, let them be afraid, because that's what they have done for a lot of people. These are people who have used starvation as a weapon against children and against civilians. These are people who bomb ports as a way for food and medicine not to get to the civilians. Okay, these people do not deserve to sleep sound at night. Don't make them beg for your tourism money. Don't make them, like, don't give them any attention. Make sure you, every time somebody thinks Mohammed bin Salman is a force for good, remind them of the fact that this man, even if, like, let's say he's not even a Muslim, okay, it doesn't matter, he has been a more source of misery than the vast majority of the worst kinds of Wahhabi Muslims. Okay, so again, I'm not biased. I don't care if he's, like, doesn't care about Islam, or if he does care about Islam, he's worse than the Wahhabis.
Okay, we have one last comment from Ahmed Qureshi saying, seems like there's something bigger here. Most hadith are not valid. Women can go to Hajj without male guardians. Memories being super pro-Saudi seems like a bigger political agenda is driving this.
I'm not sure about that.
I don't know.
They just posted the interview as it was. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, they just broadcasted the interview and they accurately represented it. I don't understand. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll put a link to the full transcript of the interview from Arab News in English, so that those of you who want to read it and actually
Something bigger is happening, and what I told you is happening, right? So they're like, people could go to theater, women can join the army, women can drive, women can go to Hajj without their guardians. The sound of Azan, the volume of Azan can be lower right now, but please, like, make sure that while you're reducing the volume of Azan, the screaming of the people who are torturing, like, now maybe people could listen to that instead. Because the volume of that is actually going to the roof, okay? And I think, like, people should not be distracted about what actually matters. Like, again, I'm happy for the woman that could drive, okay? I'm happy for the woman that can drive right now. That's great, okay? However, do not give credit to Mohammed bin Salman, okay? If somebody has tied you in their dungeon and they're fucking torturing you, okay? If they come and give you a glass of water, you don't tell them, like, oh my God, they're such a wonderful person, right? These are, like, no. Like, you could be happy for women who are can drive, and you could be happy for people to have now theaters in Saudi Arabia without giving credit to MBS. This is a sign of desperation, not the sign of these people wanting good. And this is what they're doing, is trying to distract you from what actually is happening. Okay, these people need to like fall. Like, this whole Saudi regime needs to fall apart. That's the only thing that would be progress for the Saudi people and for everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we're gonna wrap it up there. Everybody, thank you for listening. We're a little over an hour. We're definitely going to follow up. There's a lot of things that are happening right now. I mean, Israel has a new prime minister. The Iranian elections are going to happen within the next few days. So there's a lot of stuff that we have to revisit. So I think that a lot of and we're gonna have to. We're gonna talk about all of these things throughout the month. So we hope you come back. If you want to participate in this, if you're hearing this on audio, and if you want to watch us do these things live, consider becoming a patron. You go to patreon.com/sjme. You can become a patron for as little as $1 a month. And you have access to all of the live streams. You join in, you can ask your questions ahead of time. We can answer the questions live for you. And you can also ask questions live here, and you can interact with us like this. And also we do have two Q&As or more, where it's your chance to ask questions and we can ask your questions live. So do consider that. If you're watching this on YouTube, please subscribe and also hit the bell so that you get a notification every time there's a new video out. And we have all kinds of, like, fun stuff happening here that you find concerning. Yeah.
You covered everything.
I did cover everything. I'm getting good at this.
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe something happened recently.
Yeah. Maybe just remember the name of the podcast and that will be.
Yeah, I know. That's the only thing. All right, guys. So thank you very much. We're going to see you next time. Take care. Right. Be best.
Bye, guys. Be best, everyone.
The secular jihadists have been made possible thanks to the Illuminati and the covert support of Israel and the CIA. That's what we have been told, but we haven't received our checks yet. If you like what we do, please support us. Share the podcast with your friends, write and tweet us with topic and guest suggestions, or head over to secularjihadists.com and give $1 or more for exclusive access to live video. Have your questions read and answered on the air and more. Till next time, may the flying spaghetti monster be with you. We'll be right back.